Hi, it's Mountain Edition, all the news from the week here in the Roaring Fork Valley coming at you in the next half hour. I'm Zoe Rome and I'm here with Kristen Kay. Hi, Kristen.
Hey, Zoe.
Kristen, after more dry weather, fire restrictions are back in effect.
Another thing that's back is the Aspen Film Festival this week. It features films set in Aspen and around the world.
Local and national wildfire experts are gathered in the Roaring Fork Valley this week for a series of panel discussions.
Those stories and more coming up on Mountain Edition.
Due to the dry September we're having, Stage 1 fire restrictions are back in place in Pitkin, Eagle, and Garfield counties. This means campfires are only allowed within fire grates, no smoking except in a vehicle or building, and no using explosive materials. No fireworks, no shooting tracer bullets. Shooting normal ammunition, however, is still allowed. Stage 1 restrictions are also in place in the White River National Forest.
The Aspen Fire Protection District is asking voters to approve an increase in property taxes that would fund firefighter housing, capital improvements, and more. Elizabeth Stewart-Severy reports.
Ballot Issue 6A would bring in $3.3 million per year in taxes for Aspen Fire. About 40% of that would go to building firefighter housing on land the district owns near its North 40 station. The all-volunteer department requires that firefighters live in the district. The remainder would be used to create a disaster fund in case of a large wildfire and for volunteer benefits and new equipment. Chief Rick Ballantyne says the measure also addresses an automatic funding decrease resulting from Colorado's Gallagher Amendment. In 2019, Aspen Fire expects to lose about 10% of its funding because of an adjustment to the residential assessment rate. The housing portion of the tax increase would sunset after 20 years. Elizabeth Stewart-Severy, Aspen Public Radio News.
The music lineup for the 2019 X Games has been announced. Kristen has the details.
Next year's X Games will see new headliners as well as some returning favorites. Hip-hop artist Lil Wayne and electronic dance duo Louis the Child will take the stage at Buttermilk Mountain for the first time. Norwegian-born DJ Kygo and indie pop group The Chainsmokers return after performing in 2016 and 2017, respectively. The artists will also play shows at the Belly Up during the X Games, which run from January 24th to 27th next year.
I'm Elizabeth Stewart-Severy. This week, fire experts are gathered in the Roaring Fork Valley for a series of discussions about wildfire. The talks include a presentation from Gary Ferguson, the author of Land on Fire and a science writer for National Geographic. Ferguson joins me on the phone from his home in Bozeman, Montana. So, Gary, Land on Fire describes how wildfires are changing across the West. Can you highlight some of the key changes that we're seeing in fire behavior?
Well, wildfires, in a nutshell, are burning hotter, much hotter, and they're much bigger. We're having so-called megafires with some frequency, megafires being defined as a fire over 100,000 acres. We used to have those very, very infrequently, and since the year 2000, we've had about a dozen years with at least a dozen of those fires burning. And they're more dangerous. They're more dangerous because of certain conditions created by climate change, other conditions created by just the sheer size of the fires, making their own weather, and things like fire whirls, which are very dangerous to firefighters.
You mentioned that some conditions created by climate change are contributing to this. What are some of the other factors that have contributed to fires getting bigger and hotter and more dangerous?
Well, from roughly 1915 until about 1980, in the West, our fire management agencies really believed that putting out fires as quickly as possible whenever they happened was the wise way to go. Fires were actually described as sort of the enemy and the foe, and the Forest Service for a while in the early 20th century actually had a policy called the 9 a.m. rule, where they tried to put any fire that started out by 9 the next morning. Mm-hmm. And some fires do need to be put out immediately, but the problem is that when you put them all out, you allow a fuel load, fallen trees and branches and timber, to essentially accumulate on the forest floor. And in the arid West, the only way that the biomass of those old trees gets turned back into soil to grow new life is through fire. So when you stop that fire load keeps building up bigger and bigger year after year after year. And so now when fires break out because of that fuel load, it's very, very difficult, especially when you combine it with the conditions of climate change, to put those fires out.
Is it fair then to think that fire on the landscape can be a good thing? Does this mean that prescribed fire might be part of the solution?
You're absolutely right. Fire is, at base, a very, very healthy thing, besides it returning all the nutrients back to the soil so that that soil can create new life. It also has a lot to do with keeping pathogens and insect invasions at bay. Fires tend to burn in a checkerboard fashion, so you get uneven aged tree stands, and that makes for a healthier, more diverse set of environments for birds and mammals and other life. So fire is, at its heart, a very, very healthy thing, and part of us returning to a healthy forest landscape in the West will involve a prescribed burning plan.
But of course, people who have been in areas that are close to wildfires know the fear and the danger that these big and hot fires can present. And people live here because of the proximity to wildlands. Do you have suggestions about how to balance this very human desire to live close to the mountains and fire-prone areas, kind of with that inherent danger of wildfire?
Well, it's interesting. You know, we all do love to live near natural areas. And since about 2000, 40% of the development in the United States has been in the wildland-urban interface. If you want to live in the wildland-urban interface, though, there are some things that will help keep you safe without question. One is to have requirements for developers to build intelligently. Then there are some very basic things that can be done, such as kind of what firefighters call fire defense perimeters, where you just go around your home and within 10 feet of the perimeter of the house, you don't have any burnable material. You put fine mesh screen over your attic vents and your crawl space vents. You keep your gutters clean. The effect of these kinds of simple management tools is profound.
Okay, thank you so much, Gary.
It's a pleasure, Elizabeth. Thanks for having me.
That's Gary Ferguson, author of Land on Fire. I'm Elizabeth Stewart-Severy, Aspen Public Radio News.
You can hear more of the conversation with Gary Ferguson online at aspenpublicradio.org.
You're listening to Mountain Edition from Aspen Public Radio News. I'm Zoe Rome.
And I'm Kristen Kay. And Zoe, listeners tuning into Mountain Edition obviously want to stay in the know about local news.
Absolutely. And they can stay on top of what's happening with Aspen Public Radio and throughout the community by liking our Facebook page and following us on Twitter at Aspen Pub Radio.
On our Facebook page, you can interact with our station through comments on our posts and by messaging us directly.
Aspen Public Radio invites you to dive into our news reports through our Instagram account. Follow Aspen Public Radio on Instagram to see our reporters out in the field, photos of our station guests, and a celebration of life in the valley. We want to see your photos too. Tag us or use the hashtag APRNews to be part of the conversation.
And stay tuned for our ongoing coverage leading up to the midterm elections.
Last week, Garfield County Libraries named Brett Lear as their new executive director. Kristen has the details.
Lear comes to Garfield Libraries after serving as the executive director of Sonoma County Libraries and heading up a private consulting firm. Todd Anderson is the president of Garfield County Libraries Board of Trustees. He says that he hopes Lear's background will help the public library system navigate recent funding cuts so the libraries are able to buy more books and offer more programming.
We're hoping that we can use the experience that he's had, not just in the libraries, but also as a business leader.
Lear's start date is November 5th, one day before voters decide on a ballot measure that would allow Garfield County's libraries to keep money that they are currently required to return because of the Tabor Amendment. Snowmass Base Village will open this ski season despite a couple hiccups in development. Snowmass Town Council's concerns center around Building 6, which will be called Village Hall when it's complete. It's a mixed-use space, part food and beverage facility, and part community flex space. The primary developers, East-West Partners, have contributed between $6 and $7 million toward Building 6, while the town of Snowmass is on the hook for an additional $767,000.
Mayor Marky Butler expressed concern that a food and beverage operator has yet to commit to filling the space. Base Village's grand opening is scheduled for December 15th. Aspen Film Fest started this week with the documentary Howard. It's the story of Howard Ashman, the lyricist for Disney classics like Aladdin, The Little Mermaid, and Beauty and the Beast. Ashman died of AIDS when he was 39 years old. The film's writer and director, Don Hahn, worked closely with Ashman on several films. Hahn sat down with Kristen to talk about his approach to making the documentary.
Tale as old as time, song as old as rhyme, Beauty and the Beast.
So you worked with Howard Ashman throughout your career on a number of films, including Beauty and the Beast, but you were close friends as well. Do you remember the first time that you met him?
It really wasn't until October of maybe 89 or something like that. We had been working on Beauty and the Beast for a long time, and it kind of fell apart. The story didn't work, and it was a difficult fairy tale to adapt. And that's when we pulled Howard into Beauty and the Beast, because he was in just such a brilliant force on these movies. And that's when I started to obviously work with him a little closer.
He wrote some of the most iconic songs in Disney history and really in the world of musicals as a whole. Can you talk about his talent and what he was able to add to those films that he worked on?
Well, I think it's easy to throw around the word brilliant or genius or whatever, but he was in a way, and then on top of that, he had the talent to turn songs into storytelling devices. You know, you would have somebody like Ariel meeting Ursula in Little Mermaid. Ariel hardly knew Ursula existed, and by the end of the song, Ariel's given Ursula her voice. You know, so in 3 minutes, this huge plot thing happened, and that's what Howard's genius was. He was a really good storyteller.
I want to ask what it's like for you now to hear those songs.
Well, it's always a little nostalgic thinking about Howard and his contributions, you know, and some of these songs he worked on when he was suffering from HIV and AIDS and was really sick, you know, so he was writing really joyous songs like Prince Ali from Aladdin on his deathbed. You know, he was in the hospital, and Alan Menken would take a piano to his room and they'd write together. But I think that's a little bit why I want to make this movie, because there's a lot of heroism involved in this film. And quite often we tell stories of athletic heroes or political heroes or whatever. We don't have that many artistic heroes in our daily life anyway. And I think Howard's one of those.
You've said that you didn't want this documentary to be a parade of talking heads just discussing Howard, that you wanted his voice. You wanted him to tell his own story. And so you used found footage primarily. So why take that approach?
Well, I've never loved nonfiction or documentary storytelling that's just a narrator or talking heads. I think it doesn't involve the audience in the story. And what I wanted to do was take you back as an audience member and sit you at the tables that I was at. And I was lucky to be there and to put you in the rooms and place you back in that time. Well, that means finding and using old VHS video cassettes that don't look that great or finding old photos. And by using all this archival material, it actually transports you back to the 80s and 90s when this story happened. So you can live in the moment and not be pulled out by, you know, old guys and girls reminiscing.
The Colorado State Forest Service is looking to help local governments, homeowners associations, and utilities reduce wildfire risks. Elizabeth Stewart Severy has the details.
The program helps fund projects that restore forested areas and reduce wildfire risk on non-federal lands. It's aimed at helping reduce fire dangers in the wildland-urban interface, where people live close to forested areas. It's also intended to promote ecological restoration following wildfires and support forest health. So far this summer, wildfires have burned hundreds of thousands of acres in Colorado, and there are 10 fires that are active now. Organizations have until October 1st to apply for the funds. Elizabeth Stewart Severy, Aspen Public Radio Environment Desk.
This is Mountain Edition on Aspen Public Radio. I'm Zoe Rome.
And I'm Kristen Kay. In other Aspen Public Radio news, Glenwood Springs Arts and Culture Board has made the first round of selections for a new public art project.
And Pan and Fork developers head back to the drawing board. Those stories and more online at aspenpublicradio.org. Every 10 years, Colorado Parks and Wildlife, or CPW, updates how they manage deer and elk populations, and they want to know what hunters think. Hunters and outfitters offer valuable information, like how many bucks should be in a herd. CPW controls the number of animals that are hunted, as well as what season they're hunted in. People can comment at a meeting next week in Glenwood Springs, or send in their comments via email until the end of October.
Recently, the federal government recognized Mountain Family Health Centers for its services. Wyatt Orm reports it'll give the network of health centers money to improve.
More than 20,000 people in western Colorado rely on Mountain Family Health Centers for primary care, things like physical exams and teeth cleaning. The clinics also provide behavioral health care. Most of their patients are either on Medicaid or they don't have health insurance. The U.S. Health Resources and Services Administration awarded Mountain Family over $100,000 for its quality health care. The nonprofit plans to use the money to improve their electronic medical record system, among other things. Wyatt Orme, Aspen Public Radio News.
It's been a hot, dry summer in the American Southwest. In farming communities near the Four Corners, water supplies are scarce. And during dry times like these, some people are willing to do just about anything to get more of it, including stealing it. Luke Runyon has more on the man who's tasked with tracking them down. He's known as the Water Sheriff.
One morning a few years ago, Dave Hune got a call. The woman on the other end was frantic, screaming as she watched her 82-year-old husband in the yard.
And he was being beaten with a shovel by his 86-year-old neighbor.
The fight was over water. One of the men accused the other of taking more than his share from their irrigation ditch, leaving less for everyone else.
It was a situation where you had two old-timers that were very stubborn and very hard-headed, and they were bound and determined to do it their way, and the other party was saying, no, you won't.
Hune is a sheriff's deputy in Montezuma County, Colorado, bordering Utah, Arizona, and New Mexico. And unlike other local law enforcement officers throughout the West, Hune specializes in the complex world of water law. For the last decade, he's crisscrossed the county, responding to hundreds of calls.
And I'll walk up to the front door or out in that field to talk to whoever I need to talk to, and they'll turn around and look at me and give me a funny look and say, you're that water cop, aren't you? So I've kind of gotten used to that.
So how do people go about stealing water? Well, one method, you drop a pump into an irrigation ditch, turn it on, and if you don't have the water rights to do that, it's a crime. Hune has confiscated dozens of pumps, storing them in the evidence room.
And as they started to pile up, I was told not to do that anymore. So.
Method number two. You have rights to water, but not a lot. So you take more than you're allowed. Hune says this one's harder to prove. And I wanted to meet one of those people who's had neighbors stealing water.
Cortez MC-209.
Inside his black Ford pickup, Hune says depending on the nature of the crime, he'll either give a warning or write a ticket, just like a traffic stop.
People were shocked. They were like, you're kidding me, right? You're going to cite me over water? It's like, yes, it's a valuable commodity in this state.
Hello there.
76-year-old farmer Bob Schuster grows wine grapes and hay and also runs a plumbing supply store in the county's biggest city, Cortez. He's dressed in denim overalls, sporting a black and gray beard. He says water issues pop up every year, but droughts make people desperate.
Just people are basically, and these are good people, basically dishonest.
Schuster's farm is at the end of an irrigation ditch with several more users upstream. If they're taking more water than they're entitled to, it dries up before it reaches his crops.
They look out their fields, they see they need water, and they take the water going through, it's not theirs. They don't consider the neighbor needs his water.
Because livelihoods here are so dependent on water, emotions run high when accusations get thrown around. In true Hatfield and McCoy fashion, Schuster says he's had guns pointed at him, shovels swung at his head, and been sucker punched in fights with neighbors over water.
Sheriff's office, may I help you?
Right over here.
Got it.
As the day winds down, Deputy Dave Hune says violent skirmishes have declined since the county started enforcing water law. But dry years add pressure on farmers and ranchers trying to make ends meet.
Historically, we've had people killed over water in the state of Colorado. We have in this county.
His job has all the makings of a tall tale from the Wild West. But the reality is, he's in a part of the country where water scarcity is more a story about the future, not the past.
We don't want the violence. We don't want the fighting between families and between friends. We want to be able to resolve it in a nonviolent way.
And as his community becomes drier, Hugh knows he'll be spending more time, not less, keeping fights over water from blowing up. I'm Luke Runyon.
This story is part of ongoing coverage of the Colorado River, produced in partnership with public media station KUNC in Northern Colorado, with financial support by the Walton Family Foundation.
Parking in Aspen can be a nightmare. The city council wants to adopt a new parking code that will free up space downtown and clear extremely bulky vehicles from residential streets. The code targets vehicles like campers and trailers. Residents can get 4 permits per year, down from the previous 5, and use each permit for 3 days. Oversized vehicles will only be able to park in timed spots once a day. Large camper vans must purchase an $8 permit to park in neighborhoods. Under the new code, electric vehicles will still get a break parking downtown and can park for free in residential zones. The updated code will go into effect November 15th if council passes it on the second reading.
Roaring Fork Valley native Pete McBride is a photojournalist whose latest book, The Grand Canyon, Between River and Rim, came out Tuesday. It chronicles his 800-mile hike through the entire canyon and highlights developments that threaten to change the landscape. McBride recently looked through the book with Aspen Public Radio's Elizabeth Stewart Severy.
So as somebody is flipping through here, how would you characterize the experience that you want them to be able to have of the Grand Canyon?
The Grand Canyon, if you've been there, you've probably, most likely, there's two ways to see it. You either see it by the river, which is takes more time, but it's the main highway through the canyon, the Colorado River, 277 miles long, or you peer over the rim, and you're dutifully awestruck, and you're like, oh my God, that place is big. And so the book is a way to see it in a way and remind you that, wow, this is, it's more than just that one big giant overlook view, and it's more than that rapid shot that I've seen. There's this whole other world in there.
As the title suggests, McBride's book captures that world in between the river and the rim. He was joined on his hike by a fellow National Geographic journalist, Kevin Fedarko, on an adventure that spanned about a year. McBride hopes the book captures a new perspective, offers insights into the unique ecosystems, geology, and wildlife in the Grand Canyon, and entertains.
It's fun because it's a bit of a three-legged stool. It's one leg is an adventure journey, and you can follow an adventure tale of two, kind of an odd couple, walking the length of the park, maybe against our best judgment at times. So then it's, the second leg is just the beautiful photographic journey, and the third leg is a conservation message, exploring this idea that if you can't protect Grand Canyon as a national park, what can you protect? Because I think ultimately this park, being our most iconic park, probably the most known park, is a bellwether. What happens here is symbolic of what we do with lands elsewhere.
McBride details several proposed and past developments that pressure the park, including a tram that would run from the rim to the base of the canyon at the confluence of the Colorado and Little Colorado rivers. There's also proposed uranium mining close to the park, and tourism continues to grow, with hundreds of helicopter tours each day. McBride says the Grand Canyon offers a glimpse into our country's philosophical approach to national parks.
I think it's this ongoing dance we have with access and conservation and how we see wilderness. A lot of that rests on our shoulders as the public, as the public feel a desire to visit our wilderness in comfort and luxury with hand railings. That drives places like our national parks, the amenities that are offered. I fully support and agree that we have a huge number of visitors coming to Grand Canyon now. We have 7 million a year, and it's growing, and you need amenities for all people to be able to see it. But at the same time, you can't make the park accessible for everybody in every spot of the park, just like not everybody can stand on the top of Mount Everest.
McBride documented his hike through the Grand Canyon with one camera and one lens. The book includes essays alongside the photos. As he flips through the book, he reflects on how the photos can bring viewers to new places.
The Grand Canyon is probably the most photographed landscape on the planet, and so I had to do something very different. We were able to put in images that are very unique, not just because very few people have done this walk. It enabled us to use your classic Grand Canyon shots, but very unusual shots too. So we're looking at a double spread of a place overlooking Forester Canyon, which is way out in kind of the southern western section near the Great Thumb Mesa, and not many recreational hikers or tourists go to these places, so it's a way to see it in a very, very new way.
That was Pete McBride speaking with Elizabeth Stewart Severy. His latest book, The Grand Canyon Between River and Rim, was released Tuesday.
The Aspen Pedestrian Mall has been nationally recognized as one of the top public spaces in America. As Allison Bektesh reports, Aspen was recognized for its continued efforts to prioritize pedestrians.
Each year, the American Planning Association honors public spaces that provide opportunities for the community to interact and facilitate economic growth. Aspen's brick-paved walking mall was recognized for its trees and water channels and for providing a family-friendly environment. The planning process for the promenade began in the 1960s and has been a rare success story, according to the association's Colorado chapter president, Michelle Stevens.
Oh my goodness, we've lost tons of pedestrian malls. The automobile and our desire to have our drive-through coffee has really, you know, pedestrian malls struggle to be economically viable.
The award comes as Aspen works to redevelop the mall for the next 50 years. Allison Bektesh, Aspen Public Radio News.
Carbondale artists say that they need affordable housing and studio space to help them stay in town. Nonprofit ArtSpace is working with the town and the Creative District to buy land and build units. They've surveyed local artists on their housing needs, and on Tuesday, ArtSpace presented the results to the town's Board of Trustees. Arts and culture reporter Kristen Kay has been following the story and is here with me now. So tell us about that meeting on Tuesday.
A lot of artists feel like whether they can stay in Carbondale or not really depends on the cost of housing, and it was a full house. Local artists packed the meeting to hear these results and show support for this project. I spoke with Anne Grocott and Wendy Holmes from ArtSpace. They presented the data on Tuesday, and Grocott said the response rate for this survey was greater than a lot of other communities that they work with. And on that survey, 68% of the artists said they've considered leaving Carbondale because of the cost of studio space and housing, and 100% said building this project would make them consider staying.
So what else did the survey find?
Well, probably no one will be surprised to hear that there's a demand for affordable housing in the artistic community, just as there is just about everywhere else in the Valley. What makes this study a little different is that artists also said, look, we depend on affordable studio and performance space as well. So this means the project could end up involving some creative solutions like live workspace and shared art studio space, or even some shared common areas in housing.
So what happens now in the process to get affordable housing for artists actually built?
Right. So ArtSpace now works with the town and the Creative District to look for funding. Wendy Holmes from ArtSpace says she thinks a big plus for this project as far as getting built is that the town and the Creative District both want this to happen. So of course, yes, the demand for affordable housing is high all over the Roaring Fork Valley, but the town is expressing a lot of support for this because the arts are a huge economic driver in Carbondale. They bring in tourists and tax dollars, and they're part of what makes Carbondale unique. So the city wants to make sure this study doesn't just sit on the shelf now, that they work to find funding and then they start looking at designs and a location.
All right. Thanks, Kristen.
You're welcome. That's all for Mountain Edition this week. I'm Kristen Kay.
And I'm Zoe Rome. AspenPublicRadio.org is your one-stop shop for local, national, and world headlines. All of our on-air news stories are archived online, so you never miss a newscast. You can stream more podcast shows like this one and NPR special reports, browse photo slideshows, and find supplemental links to further coverage. Go deeper, go to AspenPublicRadio.org.
Thanks for listening. Mountain Edition is a production of Aspen Public Radio News.